This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I love mushrooms, especially wild mushrooms. In fact, one of the best things I've ever eaten was a Missouri wild mushroom called Hen of the Woods. It was seasoned like chorizo, but until a few weeks ago, I'd never gone foraging. So for today's show, I decided to do just that with a guide.
It is kind of like treasure hunting. Like, once you start looking for mushrooms, it adds a whole new level of difficulty to just regular hiking.
That's Alex Daniel. She's vice president of the Kansas City chapter of the Missouri Mycological Society, so she's in a mushroom club. She also works for the Missouri Department of Conservation. She's always been outdoorsy, and she comes from a long line of game hunters in Missouri.
Mushrooms are a lot easier because they can't run away.
We met up on a chilly October afternoon at Burr Oak Woods in Blue Springs. I came in layers as instructed. Alex was over by the trailhead carrying a basket.
Some of the most choice edible fall mushrooms are out right about now, like the chicken of the woods, the hen of the woods, the oyster mushrooms. There's a lot of good stuff in the fall.
I'm secretly hoping for hen of the woods.
We'll keep an eye out. That's one of the toughest ones to find because it looks just like a pile of leaves.
Yeah, everything here looks like a pile of leaves. We'll get back to that later.
What's your favorite mushroom?
My favorite mushroom is one that's out right now, too. It's called the lion's mane mushroom. It looks like a big white puffball on the side of a tree.
So that's what we want to find on our walk. The plan is amble down the trail and look at the trees.
What I like to do, and what most mushroom hunters do, is look for certain kinds of trees that are in a certain state of decay, usually half dead, all the way dead, fallen over, whatever, and then we'll go check those situations out.
Like this?
This one is good. This tree right here in front of it has some...
Ooh.
Oh, that looks like a cut there. And so you can see where something's growing up on the bottom there.
It's a little brown mushroom, which mushroom people call LBMs. It turns out thousands of different kinds of mushrooms fall into that category, and most mushroom hunters leave them alone because they're risky.
There are only a couple of mushrooms in Missouri that can fully kill you, and one of them is an LBM. It's called the deadly gallerina mushroom, and it's very small and brown, so it is something to look for. There aren't very many LBMs that you would want to consume anyway.
Noted. I definitely don't want to get poisoned. We've been walking for a little while when Alex spots something on a log.
Ooh, where? What do you see? Oh!
I see a flash of bright white, and then I see that there's a lot of that bright white. Should we head down and see what we've got?
Yeah.
Okay.
We head off trail in pursuit, pushing through thorny branches as we climb downhill over mud and rocks. Alex has a walking stick, which helps with speed, and she's already grabbed a pretty good-sized mushroom by the time I catch up. She holds it to my nose.
Check that one out. Give that a smell.
It smells good to me.
Like a mushroom?
Yes.
Should, right?
Like something I would eat,
that's
but
okay.
Should I?
Yeah, you're going to. This
Ooh.
Is the oyster mushroom.
The pattern of gills under the cap give the oyster mushroom away, but that unique smell is also a telltale sign.
To your caveman brain, doesn't that smell like food to you?
It does.
And you can see this one's been chomped on by probably slugs. Slugs love oyster mushrooms.
There are tons of oyster mushrooms growing in this patch of woods. I take so many, I almost feel greedy. But Alex says there are plenty for the taking.
I would typically, ethically, leave at least a few.
Which we do, so I'm psyched. But you might notice we haven't found the hen of the woods like I'd hoped for. I guess that since those mushrooms do look like a pile of leaves, they're pretty hard to find. But once you do find them, you can mark the tree by GPS and come back to it for years and years. And that's how Alex does eventually track down what she'd been hunting for. We're almost at the end of the trail when she stops very suddenly and looks at her phone. She's stored coordinates for a tree somewhere right around here, in the exact spot where she once found her favorite mushroom, the lion's mane. She doubles back a few steps, then points up to show me something in a tree.
Oh my god!
Isn't that
okay?
Gorgeous.
It's a big white puff of a mushroom the size of a grapefruit up overhead. We'd walked right past it.
It looks like a pom-pom, a giant white pom-pom. It's kind of nestled into the crook of that dead branch right there. And that is my favorite mushroom. That is the Hericium, the lion's mane mushroom. And I can't get it.
It's really high.
It's really high.
And this isn't a climbing tree.
This is not a climbing tree. And there are no trees next to it that are climbing trees either.
If Alex were desperate for food in like a survival type situation, she says she'd find a way. Maybe she'd fashion a tool. People do stuff like that. But her attitude on this leisurely hike is, it just wasn't meant to be. So I take a picture. She admires the mushroom from afar. And she makes plans to come back next year. That's how the hunt continues. As for how to cook with the oyster mushrooms we found and the hen of the woods we didn't, that's still to come on today's food show, which begins with this homage to the wild mushroom. Brittany Martinez is with me in the studio now. She's president of the Kansas City chapter of the Missouri Mycological Society, and she's going to be our science-y guest. Hi, Brittany.
Hi.
We also have a food guest, someone who knows how to make Missouri mushrooms taste delicious, a James Beard Award-winning chef by the name of Gerard Kraft. He's joining us from St. Louis. Hi, Gerard.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So this is extra exciting because that, remember when I said one of the best things I'd ever eaten was a hen of the woods mushroom seasoned like chorizo? I ate that mushroom like 6 years ago at Gerard's restaurant. It was called Niche, the original Niche, which has since closed. Gerard now runs the Niche restaurant group. And Gerard, not only do you remember that hen of the woods dish, I understand you still make it.
Yeah, we still make a version of it. I mean, I think that dish had, you know, a brown butter salsify puree and, you know, a deep fried egg and a few other things. But now we do it just very simply with a really good potato puree down at our restaurant, Cinder House at the Four Seasons.
Our listeners have already heard a lot of enthusiasm for the hen of the woods and the chicken of the woods, both Missouri wild mushrooms that sound like poultry. Can you talk about why they are named that way and what they taste like, just from a culinary standpoint?
Ooh, you're going to lose me on the chicken of the woods, only because I have no clue why it's named that way.
Okay.
But it does grow in my backyard, which is pretty exciting.
That is exciting.
Yeah. And they are delicious. They're very meaty, you know, which maybe that's why they felt like it just was, you know, or maybe because it looks like the coxcomb on top of the chicken. These are all guesses, though.
Okay. And then the hen of the woods. Talk to me about that one.
Hen of the woods, probably one of my favorite mushrooms out there. They come in varying sizes. I mean, I've seen monster 5 pound plus heads of hen of the woods. But you can cook them really like a steak, which is how we started to get into the idea of cooking them whole and basting them. You know, or, you know, usually we were getting, you know, anywhere from 8 ounce to a pound pieces. So you would try and get an 8 ounce piece and roast it like a piece of meat.
And so this is, I guess I had heard the theory that these mushrooms are named like poultry partly because their texture is so meaty, like almost that sort of thread-like pulled chicken texture.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I think chicken of the woods and hen of the woods are pretty different, but both very meaty types of mushrooms.
Are you from Missouri originally?
I am not, and I am not, you know, a wilderness guy by nature. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my whole family's from New York, so my parents weren't wilderness people either. But I've been here for 15 years and spent time in the Northwest and West Coast. So
that'll make you a woodsy person.
Yeah, exactly.
You've become really known in the food world for elevating ingredients that are native to Missouri. And I'm curious where wild mushrooms fit into that for you.
Oh, I mean, in a big way. Like I said, you know, right in my backyard, I have a chicken of the woods growing right down the street from my house. I found a morel patch. You know, there's there are so many great mushrooms in this area, and you know, it's such an essential part of any kind of Midwestern cuisine. I think, you know, when you're in an area that maybe doesn't have, you know, the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
That maybe doesn't have that.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't.
We've got some great, you know, since 2005 when I came here, there are some amazing farmers markets now. But you know, the growing seasons are shorter. So you really start to appreciate the things that you do have that are so wonderful. And I think mushrooms are a big part of that.
Brittany Martinez, for listeners out there who may feel inspired to take up mushroom hunting, I understand that the fall foraging season has already hit its peak, but that you can find mushrooms in Missouri year-round, even into December.
Yeah, I mean, depends on the weather. It was just warm a few days ago. It's a perfect time to go out looking for mushrooms. You can find turkey tails, even in the wintertime.
What are turkey tails?
Well, a lot of people use them to make teas with. They're considered a medicinal mushroom.
Medicinal to treat what?
All sorts of things. you could use them to, you know, just for your health or colds, cancers. Some say they have anti-cancer properties.
And this is in the some say category.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the most intimidating thing for a beginner really is the whole poison thing.
Yeah, I think that the most important thing to learn is your poisonous mushrooms. And we do teach a class on poisonous mushrooms at the beginning of the year. So,
with the Mycological Society?
Yep.
Another question that beginners, I think, are really kind of curious about is whether there are rules for where you can pick mushrooms and how you go about it.
So like on certain lands, there's rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely look in, don't just go out and pick mushrooms. Make sure that you are allowed to pick mushrooms there. It's usually they'll have signs saying don't pick mushrooms here. It's not common, but.
All right. So another question for you about I'm sorry to circle back to the poison thing, because I know that gives mushroom hunting a bad rap. Like, people are scared to try it because of this. But I think that separating myth from reality on the whole poison thing is useful. I mean, how seriously do you think people should take that threat if they're foraging in Missouri? And what's the advice you would give people as far as making sure they're mushroom hunting safely?
I definitely think if you're a beginner, you should go on a few forays with some experts or some people who know their mushrooms.
Who don't want to kill you.
Yeah. So there's only two deadly mushrooms in Missouri, but I mean, there's many deadly mushrooms in the U.S. So just because you know those two in Missouri, you go out of town and go up north somewhere and think, well, you know, there's poisonous mushrooms specific to each region. So in Missouri, there's two, and they can be confused with other mushrooms, but there's a lot of mushrooms that'll make you sick. My advice would be just to go out with some people who know their mushrooms. Never eat a mushroom unless you're 100% sure, and you'll know if you're 100% sure or not. If you have any doubt in your mind, then just don't eat it. It's not worth it. But yeah, the best way to learn a mushroom is just to go out in the woods with people who know what they're doing.
All right. Well, I want to open this up for our listeners. If you have questions about foraging for mushrooms or cooking with them, call 816-235-2888. We have experts Brittany Martinez of the Missouri Mycological Society and James Beard Award-winning chef Gerard Kraft joining us from St. Louis. 816-235-2888. Brittany, how'd you get into mushrooms? Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I have a favorite mushroom. It's the Rhodotis palmatus, and it's a pink mushroom, and it looks kind of wrinkly on top. It's sometimes called the wrinkled peach. It's really pretty and pretty rare to find, so it's like a little treasure hunt when I go out and look for it.
So it's not about food for you. It's
no,
about
actually,
the hunt.
Don't really like the taste of mushrooms, but some I do, but not. I mean, once you have a wild mushroom, it's completely different from the store mushrooms. So it's like, whoa.
I like mushrooms. But
what do you like to do with mushrooms when you find them?
I love taking pictures of things. So I love taking pictures of mushrooms, just the whole ID part of it. It's kind of with my science background. I like to ID mushrooms, take spore prints. You can make a lot of art with spore prints.
Spore prints, that's okay. I tried to do this and I failed, but I understand that what you're supposed to do is kind of under the cap, under the gills, if you place those on top of some kind of surface like glass or paper or something, and then you drip water on a little bit of water on top, the spores will come down and you can look at those under a microscope. But they also would come down in the shape of the mushroom itself.
Yeah. So there are different types of spore prints. If you have gills, you have that gill spore print. You could have pores and have a pore-like spore print. I've even got morels to spore print, which look really cool. They're ridgy. And they're yellowish color. And so there's different types of colors of spore prints. That's one way you could do it with the spore prints. I don't usually use water. I just put it on paper. If it happens, it happens. But I don't.
So they just drop down the spores.
Yeah. And you could have picked it too late. It could have already dropped its spores. You put it in a warm spot. Maybe put a bowl over it. If it's windy, try not to put it in a place where there's a lot of wind blowing around.
But this is one way you can confirm the identity of your mushroom too, if you have the knowledge to like look at spores under a microscope.
You can look at it under a microscope. Usually just the color of the spore print will tell you if it's a poisonous lookalike versus the one you are trying to eat. So if there's a question about that, usually don't use it for that purpose. I just use it for identification purposes.
So Gerard, as someone whose interest in mushrooms is very much about eating them, what would you say your favorite mushroom is right now?
You guys were just talking about the lion's mane. A friend of mine just brought us one the other day. That mushroom is really delicious. I still stand by the hen of the woods is one of the best mushrooms ever.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, porcinis. I mean, although it's not a Missouri mushroom, if you can get your hands on them, are super delicious. I don't know. I love so many different types of mushrooms, but things like king trumpets or hen of the woods, these things that are very meat-like, I find to be the best. I think when they're very delicate, I don't tend to like them as much. I still love them, but the really meaty ones that you can really roast and cook like they were meat and use them in place of an entree, those are my favorite.
You gave me some advice on cooking oyster mushrooms, which I really appreciated. You said to baste them with butter while tossing them in a pan. And this is the kicker. You said to keep trying them as you go to see how they taste at various stages of doneness while you're cooking. I did that and it was super interesting. Can you explain why you do that?
You know, I think when you're teaching yourself to cook new things, telling somebody that, sear it hard and lower the temperature and then baste in butter till it's done, or saying 5 minutes is kind of, depending on the size of the mushroom, the density of the mushroom, it's always going to be a little bit different timing wise. And I think, whether you're cooking pasta or whether you're, anything that you're cooking, you really don't know until you try it at different stages and understand what it's like at those different stages. So you really understand what you really like and where you think that perfect moment is. And that's a moving target, especially if you're using wild foods that are constantly different in size, shape, weight, everything like that.
What are some of your other tips?
Some of my other tips for mushrooms?
Yeah, for working with mushrooms in the kitchen.
The number one thing, I like to get some color on it, on the mushroom. So I like it to go into a hot pan with a little bit of oil first. So you can sear it like you were searing a steak. And then I lower that temperature. And whether I put it in a low oven or just right on the stovetop, and like I was saying, based with butter. If it's a much thicker mushroom, right after I do the searing part, I might splash a little bit of water into the pan to give it just a quick burst of steam, which kind of really loosens the mushroom up quite a bit without getting it in, you know, waterlogged or anything like that, because all the water evaporates really, really fast and just gives it a quick steam.
Well, okay, we have a couple of callers. They want to talk about mushroom hunting. We're going to talk to Maze in Kansas City. Hi, Maze.
Hello.
What is it you are looking for? And maybe Brittany can help you.
I used to live in Iowa next to a wonderful mushroom forest, and there was a grassland that had very high canopy walnut trees, so it got a lot of sun, and it was a grassland, and it would just blow up with puffballs, and they were at least 12-inch balls, probably 10 of them every year. And I found one here a year ago in Independence in a park, and it was in a dense shaded forest ditch.
Okay.
And so very confused.
I'm going to jump in and ask you quickly, is a puffball a kind of mushroom you enjoy eating, or you just enjoy finding it?
Yeah, that is my favorite edible mushroom.
Why? Describe the taste. Like, tell me about the puffball.
Yeah, it's very gamey. Mm. Maybe a third of my friends would eat it. It's so gamey, but it's also just pure white all the way through.
Yeah, you know, actually, I want to tell you, Maze, when I went hiking with Alex Daniel, we did find puffballs in Baroque Woods, lots of them. And she was telling me, Brittany, maybe you can confirm this, that if you rip it open and it's white all the way through, it's authentically a puffball. If you open it up and it's got another color in there, you don't want it.
Yeah, there's a poisonous mushroom called the pigskin earthball, and it'll be black when you split it open. And it grows in soil, and puffballs usually grow, well, the little ones at least, grow in the wood. And you won't want to eat that.
What is your advice to Maze on where to find, how to find a good location to find puffballs? Which they look like what you would think that it looks the way it sounds.
Yeah. The one she's talking about is the giant puffball. I actually found one this summer in the same kind of area, forest ditch. And, you know, that's one thing that's mysterious about mushrooms. You never know when they're going to sprout up. And sometimes they sprout in the weirdest places that you wouldn't expect them to. And it can be confusing, like she was saying. I'm confused because it was in a grassland and then it's in a forest. And yeah, that's just the way of the mushroom.
Let's talk to Michael in Kansas City. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Hey, just a quick observation. I'm a third generation morel hunter in the spring. Seems like that's what most people in Missouri go out looking for. And I love them. I love all kinds of mushrooms to eat. But just for non-mushroom hunters, I think that probably equal to most folks who head out into the woods is really just the excuse to go walk around in the woods and do it with purpose and focus. These things are really camouflaged. And you really got to kind of dial it in. And it's a sort of a zenful activity, kind of crunching around in the woods. The Japanese call it forest bathing. And I always feel better after 4 or 5 hours of walking around the woods, whether I find mushrooms or not.
Thank you, Michael. And that is a good point. That story you heard earlier in the hour, we were hiking for 2 hours. Our time is up for Mushroom Talk, but Brittany Martinez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Gerard Kraft, Executive Chef at Niche Restaurant Group in St. Louis, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, the food critics will be here to help us find delicious hot rice dishes, perfect for a cold day. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're looking for delicious rice dishes in Kansas City. A lot of different cultures have culinary specialties that use rice as their base, which can be a real platform for creativity or a familiar standby in a comfort food. Call 816-235-2888 with your favorite rice dish in town, whether it's paella, biryani, jambalaya, whatever. 816-235-2888. Today's food critics are Jenny Vergara, Sarah of Feast Magazine. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Bonjwing Lee is the ulterior epicure. He's with us today. Hi, Bonjwing.
Hi, Gina.
And Danielle Lehman. She hosts the Open Belly podcast.
Good morning.
Hello. Okay, so Bonjwing, I want to start with you because when the idea for today's topic came up, you sent us an essay you had written about rice that starts with your mom and dad each having their own separate rice cookers.
Yes. So my father grew up very poor. And so when he had to be out all day on the street selling things as a kid. And so he needed to have rice that wouldn't spoil. And so they cooked the rice, long grain rice, which was cheaper. And they cooked it with less water so that it wouldn't be as moist, so it wouldn't spoil as quickly. It's almost crackling dry. And my mother grew up in a slightly, you know, upper middle class or middle class family, and they could afford the shorter grain, sweeter, stickier rice. And so as long as I've been alive, they've always kept two rice cookers because they can't stand eating each other's
meat.
That
is so interesting.
I think that that's such an illustration, too, that a food that might be dismissed as just like there's rice and.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah.
And that's true.
It's kind of seen like a vanilla kind of background thing. But I think, you know, childhood memories really form, you know, for the rest of your life. It informs how you eat. And so, yeah.
Rice
I prefer my mom's rice. I like it.
And what does that say about your upbringing?
I don't know.
You are recommending, Bonjwing, just one rice dish today from a Chinese restaurant in Kansas City, and that is?
Well, I don't know what it's called in English. I'm not even sure it's printed on the menu, but I know that you can call ahead and ask for it. It's in Chinese, it's called Xian Yu Cao Fan. It means salted fish fried rice. It's a salted cured fish. It's very pungent. So warning, do not order it if you're afraid of pungent things. It's very pungent.
And you get this at Kinlin.
And Kinlin, over by UMKC campus. And there may be other places that do it, but it's usually not on the menu regularly, so you usually just have to.
Bowling's also does one.
Do they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is it on the menu?
It is on the menu.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
What is special about this dish to you?
I just like salty things. I like salty fish. I love anchovies. So it's kind of got that same, you know, but the fish has been cured and dried. So then they reconstitute it. And then it's little bits of it in the rice. It's not like a whole piece of it. So it's kind of just flavors the rice. And I just love it.
Is there anything else? Other veg?
Yeah, usually sometimes there's chopped up vegetables in it. Just whatever you would normally think of as a fried rice, but just with these little salty bits of really stinky Chinese cured
I would
fish.
Love that. Yeah. I would totally love that.
It sounds really good.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny, as long as you are recommending some things at Bowling's.
I am. In fact, I was just there on the hunt for rice dishes. I had their sizzling, it's basically called sizzling rice chicken soup on the menu. And it's an appetizer. It's made for two. And it was a really cold night. I took my son in there. And it was the most simple but yet comforting. And in this case, rice is not necessarily the main component of this. It is fried until it's kind of crispy. And so it's a little bit soft on the outside, but there's definitely a hard core to the center of the rice, which makes it kind of crunchy to eat in the soup. So it adds almost as a texture point. And the broth in this soup is a very clear chicken broth. It is pristine. It's beautiful. And then it just has some simple snow peas, a few mushrooms, a little bit of onion. And then at the very last minute, they throw this kind of fried rice on top that starts to absorb the liquid and get a little soft on the outside, crunchy on the inside. So as you're eating this soup, you've got this interesting kind of texture point. It was delicious. We ate the whole thing.
And also, I really love in the sizzling rice soups, mm-hmm. just the aroma of that toasted rice.
Absolutely.
I think to me, that's just the best part of it.
Absolutely.
I mean, the crunchy is great, but yeah.
Yep.
If anyone hears a growl, that is my stomach. Danielle, your podcast shines a light on the foods made by immigrants in Kansas City. So in the time you've been doing this, I imagine that has really guided your food explorations here in town. And I'm curious about whether that has shaped how you think about rice.
Yeah, I mean, when you said we were doing a rice topic, immediately my brain started firing with so many different recommendations. I really had to pare down my list because rice is such a versatile ingredient that's used by so many different cultures. So I could go on and on about rice.
Well, let's
rice
be real. There's 20 items on your list, right?
I think I cut it down to 12.
Oh, my gosh. I looked
you
at your list.
You cut it down to 12.
I looked at your list and I thought, I'm just going to spend the entire show going, I defer my time to Danielle.
Same here.
I've eaten a lot of rice this year.
So I am curious, before we launch into those recommendations, based on your informal observations, do you see rice filling a similar function in one cuisine and another, or do you see it as being very distinct?
I think that's a really interesting question. So I once interviewed a couple that were both from China, and one of the families grew up eating rice as their side kind of grain or carbohydrate, I guess, and the other one preferred bread. And so I think if you think about rice or potatoes as bread, or bread as kind of that filler that is the vessel to soak up the sauce or whatever else that you're eating with it, they all kind of serve a similar function. But what I love about some of the things that we put on my list are that the rice is really the focal point of the dish and not just kind of an afterthought that's soaking up sauce.
So take me to Fanny's African Market.
I love Fanny's African Cuisine. They are on the corner of Troost and 41st. And Fanny Gibson is the owner and chef. She immigrated from Liberia when she was in high school and just really missed a lot of the food that she grew up eating and decided to open Fanny's African Cuisine. There are so many incredible dishes on the menu there, but one of the most popular is an item called jollof rice, and it's a rice dish cooked with tomato paste and onion and peppers, and it doesn't actually have any hot peppers in it, but it has a little bit of spice to it, and you can get it with chicken or whatever protein you want. It's just a really flavorful, almost kind of Caribbean flavor profile dish that everybody loves, so if you are curious about trying West African cuisine, that is a dish that will definitely be a crowd pleaser.
Take me also to KC Grill and Kebab.
Yeah, so it's been a while since I've been there, but there is a dish that I love in Persian cooking called tadig, and it's also kind of a crunchy rice. It's cooked in a pan where it gets very hot on the bottom so that the bottom layer is really crunchy. At KC Grill and Kebab, they serve it with sabzi or stew that could be poured on top, but the crunchy part of that rice is the best part. I feel like normally when you get a dish that you're going to share with a group, you kind of want the first perfect bite. But with tadig, you kind of want the last bite because that's where all the crunchy bits are.
I love that. Where is the perfect bite? It's at the end.
Yes.
It is. Same with paella. You get
Agreed.
That sakarat at the bottom of the pan.
That's
I mean,
right.
it's delicious.
That okay, so let's stuff. Talk paella. Jenny Jarocho.
Yeah, Jarocho, I mean, obviously we all know Carlos Falcón. He has an incredible access to fresh seafood. So he does a seafood paella, and it's maybe meant for two. It's in a smallish plate. It's not like a big giant thing, but it's perfectly seasoned saffron-based rice. So the rice is really, really bright yellow. He's got some other spices in there, but it's not a spicy dish at all. It's just perfectly seasoned. You know, nods its head towards Spanish cuisine, but I'm sure he's got some Latin flavors in there. And then he just does, you know, clams and mussels and shrimp and scallops and I think squid. And it's delicious. It's a bite of seafood in every bite. He has plenty of seafood in this dish. And so it's a little bit of rice, a little bit of seafood, and it's beautiful. It's really, really simple and delicious.
Tell me about the sticky rice you are recommending at Barami Thai Bistro.
So this is more of a dessert nod. I was thinking, well, certainly we can find some sort of restaurant doing a dessert with rice. And then I was like, oh, yeah, Barami Thai in the Crossroads does a mango sticky rice. And so what this is basically traditional sticky rice that she cooks down with coconut milk, and it makes it just really lovely and kind of creamy. And then she slices thin slices of mango on top and drizzles a little bit of coconut syrup over that with a dash of sesame seeds on top. And it's just simple and it's flavorful, and you get kind of a little coconut nuttiness to it, as well as like this really lovely ripe mango. It's perfect. Perfect way to end a meal.
And Danielle, speaking of rice for dessert, you actually have a Rice Krispie treat on your list.
Who doesn't love Rice Krispie treats?
No
one.
Let's
be honest.
No one.
So I like going to the Russell in Midtown. I like going there because you can get a really nice salad. You feel really good about the choice you made for lunch, and then you follow it up with a 500-calorie decadent dessert. They have a really amazing Rice Krispie treat that they used to make, I think, well, it had butterscotch chips in it, and there I think there was a layer of chocolate on it, but now they've actually started making it with a layer of cookie crumble on top so that it can be gluten-free.
Go on.
And it's just, you know, it's an upgraded Rice Krispie treat. It's an upgrade on a classic, and it's amazing.
And this is at the Russell.
The Russell, yes.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if there is a rice dish you love on a Kansas City menu or something you love that you have not been able to find here in town. Our critics might be able to help. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will be right back. I I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Standard, Central Standard. I'm really hungry, which is why I can't say the name of the show that I host. And we're talking about rice, delicious rice dishes from cultures all over the world, all served in Kansas City restaurants. You can call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Today's food critics are Jenny Vergara of Feast Magazine, Bonjuing Lee, The Ulterior Epicure, and Danielle Lehman, who hosts the Open Belly podcast. Hi again, you guys.
Hi.
Hey. Howdy.
Let's dive right back into these recommendations. You've got a lot of them, and they all sound really amazing. Danielle, take me to Pollo.
Ooh, Pollo. So Pollo is right off of Southwest Boulevard, and they are known for their wood-fired chicken, but they have some amazing side dishes, too. And one of my favorites is the kimchi fried rice. So Carlos Mortera and his father, also Carlos Mortera Sr., run this restaurant together, and they make all of the kimchi in-house. It's a spicy, kind of savory, also a little bit crunchy dish as well, and it just pairs really perfectly with wood-fired chicken.
Let's also talk about biryani, just in general. Both Danielle and Bonjuing are recommending places for biryani. And Bonjuing, I'm going to start with you on this one. Explain what biryani is and where you like to get it in Kansas City.
Well, biryani is a Indian rice dish, typically from the northern part of India. I think it has some Muslim influences in the northern part of India. And usually there's meat in there. And the place that I put down was Culture Curry down in, I think it's technically Overland Park on College Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And they have quite a bit of biryani on their menu. And
like several different options.
Different options. You can get it with, I think, goat, I think, or lamb or chicken and, you know, different meats and vegetables.
Yeah. I have also seen biryani on Middle Eastern restaurant menus, which is sort of interesting.
It's a crossover. It's like another Indian dish called pulao, which is pilaf, or seen in different ways, in different versions all across the world.
What are some of the aromatics that are typically part of a biryani dish?
So there's usually some version of curry spices in it. So you're going to, it's a very savory dish. The pulao that I recommended from Siva actually incorporates fruit in it. There's pineapple into it. So sometimes there's dried raisins or raisins and other fruits.
Fruits
into
and nuts,
it.
I and believe, nuts, too.
Yeah.
Yum. Danielle, you like to go to Sohalia's Kitchen for biryani?
Yes. So Sohalia's Kitchen in the Lenexa Public Market has a chicken biryani. I believe it's on the menu every day. Theirs is very fragrant, a lot of saffron as well. I know theirs is served with a yogurt sauce on top, which adds a little bit of brightness. Mm. So I think there definitely are some variations from region to region. But Sohaila and her family are from Pakistan, and so that was kind of their traditional version of the chicken biryani.
Jenny, tell me about Casey Koshery.
Casey Koshery is a food truck. An Egyptian, lovely Egyptian couple have the food truck. And they're relatively new. I think within the last year, they've hit the streets of Kansas City. But they're doing basically kind of this street food version of a very popular Egyptian dish in Egypt called koshery. And it's just like a big carb bomb. I mean, if you can imagine this. So it's got rice in it for sure, kind of short grain white rice. And then it has pasta and it has lentils. And it has kind of this spicy cumin tomato sauce that it's mixed with. And it also has like two different condiments that you can put on it. One is kind of a garlic vinegar that's obviously adds a little bit of kind of bite to it. And then more of a hot sauce, like a red pepper kind of hot sauce that you can add to kind of doctor it up. But all these things kind of, and it's really meant to just be a inexpensive, filling way to get something quick on the streets in Egypt. And
super comfort food tasting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit hard to find in Kansas City. I haven't really seen it too much on kind of other Middle Eastern-ish restaurant menus. So it's cool that she's just dedicated her truck to that. She does do a few other things on the truck. That's not the only thing. But if you're going to go to a truck called Casey Koshery, you must get the koshery.
You must. Let's talk to Spike, who has called us from Kansas City. Spike, what do you want to recommend?
Extra Virgin in Kansas City, down in the crossroad. They do a fried rice that's really kind of crunchy. And it's got shrimp and other little vegetables in it. And it's just a really texture, little pleasure dish to eat.
Okay, so you like a crunchy fried rice at Extra Virgin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and especially on Wednesdays, because I'm a chef, you get 50% off for industry night.
Nice. Okay.
Here.
Well, thanks for that call, Spike. And so I would say that we're talking about kind of like a maybe high-end rice dish. And so while we're in that kind of a zone, Jenny, take me to the Rieger.
Yeah, so again, this is another tadig. This is a mushroom tadig, and I think I have actually mentioned this before on the show, but it's a dish that right now is still on the menu, but probably won't be for long. So if you're interested in trying Howard Hanna's version, please get in there. But basically, it uses local mushrooms. It does have the crispiness to it. He's got some other things kind of topping the tadig, so the crispiness is a little hidden. It's kind of a nice surprise as you kind of put your knife into it. But it basically has a little bit of eggplant, mushrooms, tomatoes, some herbs, and there's a cooked quail egg that's kind of hidden also in the middle of it, which is really interesting. And it was part of just kind of a little bit of a small plates extravaganza that I shared with friends. And it was really a nice surprise to kind of get to the quail egg. So, yeah, I love it. It's a vegetarian kind of, other than the quail egg, kind of a vegetarian nod. So
that sounds delicious. And Danielle Lehman, there's a dish that you are describing as like a lamb shank with saffron rice.
Yes. So Queen Sweets and Bakery up in the Northland have a number of dishes on their menu that are served with their saffron rice. And it is a side dish, but their saffron rice is so amazing and delicious. Anything that you get on the menu with their saffron rice, I recommend. Their rice is made with tomatoes, onion, a lot of fresh herbs. They actually gave me a bag of mint to take home and to put on top of the rice, which was really a nice touch. I prefer the lamb shank there. They do a very high-end lamb shank. I mean, you could look at this dish and think it would come out of any high-end restaurant in Kansas City. It's just braised until it's very tender and falls right off the bone. And if you love lamb, you're going to love that lamb shank.
I do. I do love lamb.
That couple is doing such a good job up there.
Yeah.
Really, their restaurant is amazing. And they do fine dining stuff in this kind of more casual environment. So.
Yep.
So, speaking of going to a restaurant and then ordering the rice because the rice is so good, I just thought of Joe's Kansas City, you think of as barbecue.
I do.
But if you've never tried their dirty rice, dirty rice is delicious.
Tell us about it.
Well, it's a little bit spicy. It's everything you want out of dirty rice. It's flavorful. I actually asked them because I was so curious. There is actually liver in it. It's, you know, sausage and liver. And so it's pretty dirty, and it's pretty flavor. It's very flavorful.
For those who have never had dirty rice, can you explain what it is intended to be?
It's comfort food, I think. Like, most rice dishes, it's a way of being filling, taking leftovers and dumping them all in a pot.
That's it.
And cooking it down, and then a very economical way of filling your tummy.
It's not pristine white rice, but dirty rice.
Yeah, and it's also extremely delicious. Yeah.
Spicy often.
And spicy. And their version is slightly spicy as well.
So something that a couple of you have recommended is a dish called bibimbap, a Korean dish. Danielle, start us off with the bibimbap you are recommending.
So I have two on my list. And Bonjuing and I were speaking about what would be considered a traditional bibimbap. Because when I think of traditional bibimbap, I think of Korean restaurants where you go in and you get what's called dulsat bibimbap, which comes in a stone pot. And again, the rice on the bottom becomes crunchy because of the stone pot. It's served with meat and pickled vegetables and usually a fried egg or just a cracked egg on top that cooks as you kind of mix up the rice with your spoons.
From what I understand, the term bibimbap involves mixing.
And I think it's generally it was like a bowl of rice that you put all the banchan on it, and then you'd mix it up with leftover meat or whatever.
So I like to get that version at Soban, which is on Shawnee Mission Parkway. They do a really nice, what I would picture as a traditional version. However, at Sura Eats, which is a very fast casual Korean restaurant in the parlor, they also have a bibimbap. And when I spoke with the chef Kyung Kim there, he said, you know, this is how he ate bibimbap growing up. So there's really an argument for what is the traditional way to eat bibimbap. His is served with just white rice that's steamed or cooked in a rice cooker. It's doesn't have the stone pot with the crunchy texture, but it has the same ingredients, same banchan on top. And he said, you know, when he was a kid, he would come home, just open the fridge, see what leftovers were in the fridge, throw some rice in a bowl with all of the banchan that was from the night before, and that was bibimbap to his family.
I think that's more commonplace because it's easier to make. You don't have to heat up this huge stone crock. But I think the stone crock one, I love it because when you get to that crispy part at the very bottom, sometimes it sticks to the stone pot and you can't get it off, and sometimes they'll pour tea into it.
Oh,
that helps you kind of get that rice back up. It's delicious.
Jenny, a couple of different bibimbaps there. I'll just say in summary, Sir Eats and Soban both having their own argument for a version of what could be considered traditional.
Now, does Soban do the dulsat?
Yes,
the
do.
Hot? Okay.
Yes.
Yep.
And then, Jenny, you are recommending something at Waldo Thai Place.
Yeah, actually, Danielle and I think both have this on our menu. And I have to tell you, you know, she and I are going to arm wrestle later as to who loves it more. But I'm going to profess my love first.
Wait, we're not going to do that right now.
I'm going to profess my love first because I got to go first. This is Khao Todd Nam Sad. And this is basically a dried Chinese sausage and rice dish. And the rice is pressed into kind of tight balls, if you will, and then fried really crispy and kind of mixed in. So there's a little soft rice, a little crunchy rice, a little like kind of funky dried Chinese sausage in there. It's also full of all kinds of aromatics, basically cilantro, red onion, scallion, peanuts, I think, are mm-hmm. in there as well. And it's just all tossed together. And I think it's an appetizer on the menu, yes. if I remember correctly. But I could eat that as my whole meal. And you basically kind of stuff it into lettuce leaves, kind of fold it up into a little packet and enjoy it. And it's absolutely one of the most flavorful dishes I've ever had. I continue to wake up in the middle of the night craving this dish. Like, this is the thing that's one of those, like, I want that dish. And the only place I can go to find it is Waldo Thai. Mm-hmm.
That makes me want to get it, but it also makes me not want to get it because I don't want to wake up in the morning in the middle of the night desperate.
Just order two so you have one.
That's right. That's right.
Danielle, could you possibly add anything to that gushing
Fight
review?
Me. Fight me.
I will say, yes, you're supposed to wrap it up in lettuce, but for me, I just eat it with a fork because the lettuce gets in the way of the rice and I just want to enjoy the rice.
And Bondring, you have a recommendation you have alluded to but not fully explained, which is a recommendation at Seva in Liberty.
Yes, that was the pulao that mm-hmm. I was talking about earlier. That is that their version of it is spicy. It's got the fruit in it. It's got pineapple. So you've got that little bit of a salty, sweet thing going on in the rice. And that's also a very common Indian rice dish. But like I said, we see it across the world in dishes like pilaf or, you know, in the southern part of the United States, purlao mm-hmm. and purlu and all those other different versions of pilaf. So it's just a flavorful, aromatic rice that's been, you know, cooked with meat and spices.
Jenny, tell me about Little Oranges, which doesn't sound like a rice dish.
Well, it's basically the name for arancini, if anybody's ever had this kind of traditional Italian appetizer. It is a way to use leftover risotto, which they serve at Plate Restaurant in East Brookside. So these little oranges are found on their antipasti menu at Plate. And I've had them in other restaurants where they're kind of golf ball size. These are good little orange size. I mean, this is a mandarin orange size arancini. It's a nice size. The plate comes with, I believe, four of them, and they are fried crispy, breaded and fried on the outside with risotto, leftover risotto on the inside. In this case, they're using a saffron risotto. And then they stuff the middle at plate with beef short ribs, which is really, really good. And then top it with a little bit of basil oil. It has a little sun-dried tomato sauce and a little sprinkle of cheese on top. And it's crunchy on the outside and creamy on the inside and then a little bite of meat. I think they're really good,
so it's actually quite substantial if they're the size of a... Wow.
Yes. And I got them as an appetizer with an entree behind it, and that was a mistake. I boxed up my entree pretty quick.
We have not even talked about risotto, which could probably be a whole show in and of itself because it's becoming so common on menus.
Yes, and also rice noodles. I didn't know how far you wanted to venture into the rice territory. There's so many things made with
rice. I have horchata on my menu,
on my list.
Before we go, give us that recommendation, Jenny. Where should we get horchata?
Horchata at Pirate's Bone Burger. He's actually always been known for his coffee, but he does an amazing plant-based horchata, which is just basically his own rice milk that he makes in-house, adds a little vanilla, a little cinnamon, a little spice to it, and he mixes it with coffee and calls it a dirty horchata, which is also delicious. So
yum. Well, you guys, it's obvious, but we got to go. The list of the best rice dishes in Kansas City will be online at kcur.org over the weekend. It will include stuff we didn't even get to this morning. kcur.org and kcur.org/Central Standard. Jenny Vergara with us from Feast Magazine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bonjuing Lee, Ulterior Epicure. Thank you.
Thanks, Gina.
And Danielle Lehman with the podcast Open Belly. KC, this has been great.
Thank you.
That's a wrap. You can find anything from today or from the week at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where we archive all our past shows, and you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. That's also where you can see pictures from my mushroom hunt. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, Noah Taborda, and our senior producer, Sylvia Maria Gross. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.